Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel is calling for a fresh round of technology innovation to assure America's military superiority. The push is part of what Hagel described as a game-changing strategy to sharpen the nation's military edge, even with tight budgets. Bob Martinage is former Navy Undersecretary and technology aide to Defense Secretary Robert Gates. Now he's a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. He joins me now to talk about this initiative. Bob, good morning. Thanks for being on.
Good morning. It's my pleasure.
All right. So let's talk about how this might be structured, a commission like this. What would it look like? Because we've had them before in the past. What do those look like?
Hagel has called for establishing what he referred to as an advanced capability and deterrent panel, which will be chaired by Deputy Secretary Work. And that panel will spearhead and drive the overall effort across the Department of Defense. He also created a long-range research and development planning program to rebalance the R&D portfolio. Both those entities have very close parallels to ones established by Secretary Brown during the 1970s to implement his offset strategy at the time.
And you've written that there are even lessons to be learned now from the 1950s strategy under President Eisenhower called New Look. How does that work?
That actually was when he came into office after the, in the wake of the Korean War and facing Soviet threats around the world, kind of came to the conclusion that we couldn't afford to match the Soviets man-for-man, tank-for-tank, every place in the world, and instead to rely more heavily on long-range global attack capabilities, air power, and nuclear weapons. And the way that came about was actually a senior-level NSC study over the summer called Project Solarium, because the decision to have this strategy review is made in the Solarium at the White House.
And so you might say that maybe it looks antiquated now, but that nuclear deterrent long-range capability did work for many, many years.
Yes, it did, and it allowed us to reduce the amount of expenditure of GNP on defense as well as the amount of federal spending on defense in the overall budget pretty significantly over that period.
And so now the threats we're facing don't look very much like the Soviet Union. They look more like ISIL and al-Qaeda and all those kinds of things. And so is that so-called imbalance, is that something that you think Hagel is trying to get at? Quality?
I think that's part of it. I think what also is going on is, as Secretary Hagel has mentioned, is the diffusion, proliferation of asymmetric capabilities in the form of what's called anti-access or area denial capabilities that really undermine our ability to project power the way we traditionally have over the last several decades. So things like threats to close-in air bases and ports, the growing vulnerability of surface ships, including aircraft carriers, increasingly lethal integrated air defense systems, and the loss of our sanctuary in space. And while in some cases it's advanced militaries and countries that are developing these capabilities and fielding these capabilities, and in some cases it's non-state actors like Hezbollah. So I think that's really the core problem that they're trying to address.
Because if you look at the developments that are said to have come out of the 1970s, look at all of this, such as stealth coatings on aircraft and guided missiles, and now we have drones. It seems like those technology should still be effective against the anti-access and anti-denial capabilities out there.
Well, they worked for a long time, and we got a great advantage during arguably the second offset strategy in the 1970s that you're referring to, with ISR and precision-guided weapons and stealth, as you've said. But other countries have seen us use those, really since the first Gulf War, and have taken steps to counter them, and in some cases to develop their own ISR and strike capabilities. So that's kind of the problem. We had a monopoly in these technologies for a long time, and now other countries around the world are fielding, as good or in some cases better capabilities, and we need to respond to that.
Because as just an aside, the new fighter that the United States will be relying on is very stealthy, and it's also supposed to be used in close-in, not necessarily high-altitude dogfights, but it's something down lower to go in. But it sounds like you're saying that that advantage that is touted for the F-35 may not be such an advantage in the new world ahead.
It's not clear to me that the F-35 capabilities are keeping pace with the networked integrated air defense systems that are being fielded around the world. And in addition to the stealthiness, it may not be sufficiently stealthy. The second problem is it also is relatively short range. So it's a threat posed to the in-theater pacing that the F-35 operates from.
All right. And so going back again to that 1970s, did the military planner say, I wish we had a plane that can't be seen by radar, and I wish we had a missile that can go and land on a dime and so forth? Did they know what they want and then go find the technology to create it? Or did they have an open sheet and say, what do we need here? And that's what came back from industry.
I think it was more the latter. I mean, in both that case, and I would argue in this case, the first step is to say, what is the operational problem that needs to be solved? What's my concept for addressing it? And then what are the technologies or capabilities I need to implement that concept? So in the 1970s, the operational problem was that Soviet ground forces outnumbered NATO by roughly 3-1 on the central front in Europe. The operational concept for addressing that was to see deep and shoot deep into the Warsaw Pact territory to destroy Soviet second echelon forces before they could be brought to bear. So in order to do that, in order to see deep and shoot deep, it was determined that we needed new intelligence surveillance reconnaissance systems and new precision-guided munitions and things like stealth aircraft. So you kind of have to go through that order. You know, what's the problem? What's my concept for addressing it? And then what are the technologies or capabilities I need to do it? So now we have an understanding of what our current operational problem is. But the hard work of this panel is going forward will be coming up with what is the operational concept I need to project power differently. And once there's some agreement about that, then the next question becomes, what are the new technologies or capabilities I need to implement that operational concept?
We're speaking with Bob Martinage. He's a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. And so if industry is involved in this whole research project that the secretary has called for, because eventually you're going to need industry to build this stuff, how do you make sure that they don't simply try to keep pushing in a subtle way what it is they know they can already build?
I think that's why it has to be rooted in accurately identifying what is that operational problem, and then what's my concept for dealing with it, and then, no kidding, what are the systems and capabilities I need to address it? If those capabilities that industry is offering don't help implement that concept and don't help me address the problem, then you look for other alternatives.
Because if you look at the names that dominated technology leading up to and through World War II, the names like Boeing and Lockheed and Martin and Northrop and all that, it was all individuals, we could see maybe the birth of a whole new defense industrial base that nobody knows who it is yet.
All things are possible. There's a lot of promising technologies in the commercial sector that may be brought to bear to solve some of these problems. I think that the traditional defense industry has a lot of creative, interesting ideas on how to solve some of these problems. So I'm sure it will be a mix of, you know, potentially some new sources of technology for the military, as well as more traditional sources.
And how does doctrine move along with this? Because when you have whole new systems and delivery ways to meet new challenges, doctrine has to change in terms of how the military operates. So do you wait until you know what you've got to change doctrine, or does doctrine lead the way?
I think I go back to the point about what is your operational concept for dealing with the problems you face. And from that concept, that then gets enshrined over time in doctrine. So before you can have the doctrine, to get into the nitty-gritty of that, you need to know generally what your operational concept is for fighting in the future. And then the doctrine will follow as you learn lessons and figure out the details of how to implement that concept.
And looking through the essay that you've written that's published online at CSBA, it's almost like a reversal of the 1950s in the sense that we were outnumbered, as you say, by the Soviet conventional forces, so we developed this capability of going behind them and blowing up all their cities. In this case, we outnumber, seemingly, the enemy like Al-Qaeda and Hezbollah and so forth we're the ones that outnumber them, and yet they have this denial capability. So it's almost as if it's 180 degrees different from the 1950s.
Yeah, while in terrorism and insurgencies and sort of hybrid threats that you're kind of referring to are part of the problem, I think where the Defense Innovation Initiative is focused is more on the longer-term threats to our core conventional power projection capabilities. So the way we use aircraft, the way we use our surface combatants, and so forth. And there, it's not clear that we have a numerical advantage. We're feeling fewer and fewer of these systems over time as they get more expensive in part. So we have fewer resources. And then adversaries are developing less expensive missiles, for example, that can hold those limited number of platforms at risk. So the numerical balance isn't between ship to ship, but it's maybe between ship and missiles, or aircraft and missiles, or air bases and missiles. And that's where one of the things we need to address.
So is the unstated danger here in all of this really China?
I think China is the pacing threat. I don't think, the severest threat and most advanced in many respects and in terms of scale. But other countries around the world are also fielding more increasingly accurate long-range ballistic and cruise missiles, like Iran. Lots of countries are fielding very capable integrated air defenses with SA-10, SA-20-like technologies, as well as long-range anti-ship cruise missiles. So while China's the pacing threat, I think we see these challenges and threats popping up around the world.
And so I hate to say this, but in some ways that makes the ICBMs we have and have had in the ground for all these years possibly more relevant.
I don't think they'll become more relevant. I think nuclear deterrence will continue to be important to backstop whatever we do in the conventional realm. But the question becomes, how do we, for instance, if close in bases are at risk, that would suggest that we need longer range aircraft. Whether those aircraft are coming from an aircraft carrier or from land bases, it would be highly desirable for them to have longer range than currently is the case. Because of the air defense threat they face, it would also be highly desirable for them to be increasingly stealthy or more difficult to detect or otherwise more survivable. And also less dependent on space for guidance and communications. And so you kind of go through the list of, you know, if the problem is, you know, our air bases and ports are at risk, our surface ships are at risk, integrated air defense systems are increasingly lethal, and we can't necessarily rely on space to the extent we have in the past, then okay, what's that mean for the mix of forces that we need for the future?
Fascinating stuff. Bob Martinage is a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, and he's got an essay which we'll post along with this interview later this morning. Thanks so much for joining me.
My pleasure. Have a great day.